From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Seems that we have to figure out how to grapple with a demagogue. Don't take my word for it. Search demagogue on Google News and you get this.
And then you have demagogues like Trump come along. He says, I know what the cause of your problems is.
Where Trump is demagoguing and getting up and saying Obama's going to take your guns.
Donald Trump, a demagogue with a soft spot for a dictator.
But Michael Signer, author of the book Demagogue, The Fight to Save Democracy from Its Worst Enemies, says a true demagogue must meet 19th century writer James Fenimore Cooper's four criteria. One, they must pose as a mirror for the masses. Two, they must trigger great waves of emotion. Three, they must use that emotion for political gain. And four, they must seek to break the established rules for governance. Cooper was by no means the earliest to fear demagogues. That worry dates back to the ancient Greeks. Signer says it was also very much on the minds of the founding fathers.
There are several institutions that we have that are meant to protect us from the danger of demagogues. One of them is the U.S. Senate. It was meant to be kind of a house for statesmen who would see it as their mission in American public life to lead us kind of away from temptation and toward higher accomplishments.
Mm-hmm. How did that work out?
You're right. I mean, the Senate really is not functioning anywhere as well as it was designed to be by the founders. Madison described the Senate as, the quote was, a necessary fence against fickleness and passion.
Which brings us to Donald Trump, who you maintained for years was not technically a demagogue, and yet just recently you say that he is.
Two reasons. True demagogues posture as mirrors of the masses. His image was the man of golden skyscrapers and personal golf courses. And that changed when he started really trying to almost merge into this mass of angry white voters.
They're coming, not coming at me. They're coming at all of us. Because, you know, we have a noisy majority. They used to call it the quiet majority. People are fed up.
The second thing that's more concerning is that fourth rule of the demagogue, that they threaten or break established rules of governance. In the last weeks, he has started stampeding across that boundary, not only telling lies, but we're an open society. So closing the country to people of one religion violates Americans' constitutional tradition. And not only doesn't he seem to care, he seems to be doing what demagogues throughout history have done, which is trying to create a kind of state within the state of people who are accountable only to him. And he's setting the rules. And that is what demagogues do.
So how does one counter a demagogue?
They are slippery. And they're slippery because they have this lifeline to a mass of millions of people who love them.
I spoke in front of thousands of people last night. That when thousands of people couldn't get in, they gave a standing ovation as soon as they heard it.
That said, the U.S. Senate has really proven over time to be a natural place for confronting and defusing a demagogue.
So give me an example of how the Senate countered a demagogue in the past.
Joseph McCarthy, you know, he was a classic demagogue, and he had a very damaging run in our country. But in the spring and the summer of 1954, in the U.S. Senate, there was held what was called the Army McCarthy hearings. And over a period of weeks, he was systematically confronted. And the peak was when an attorney named Joseph Welch said,
"Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you left no sense of decency?"
The millions of people that were watching had decided for themselves that this was no longer the kind of country and the kind of leader they wanted.
But let's say that McCarthy is running for president in 2015. Mm-hmm. Is he going down?
He's not going down if the abdication of responsibility that we've seen from so many leaders in the rise of Trump was occurring.
So if we can't rely on the Senate to fulfill one of the functions that the founding fathers hoped to build into that institution, how are the media to deal with Trump?
Not let him drive coverage toward areas that are purely self-serving. You know, when I've watched a lot of interviews with him, these anchors have just let him run on and on. the real thing that needs to happen now is men and women of conscience who are in leadership positions in this country need to take this on squarely, not by lampooning him, not by playing into the entertainment shtick, but by calling Americans back to the basic values that are what we're proud of.
You say lampooning doesn't work?
My study of demagogues shows that satire does not work. The rules in the normal state are we value constitutional principles. We think about individuals in terms of who they are individually, not stereotypes. In Trump world, none of those things matter. So when you lampoon him or you satirize him or you call him a clown or carnival barker, none of that matters because they're showmen and they get how to agitate and connect with people in a way that, you know, ordinary mortals do not. So I think the thing is actually taking a demagogue seriously in their claims and educating the audience about how the demagogue's claims and what they're doing actually hurts the country. So that requires a slightly different approach. It doesn't begin in this squawk of outrage. It doesn't start with the temperament that the demagogue has initiated.
You have to take him soberly and seriously.
And that's what the history of successful confrontations with demagogues has shown.
You are optimistic that the American people will overcome what you suggest could be an existential threat to the nation. Why? You're not going to invoke American exceptionalism, are you?
Oh, I am. I wasn't going to, but you got me. Demagogues thrive when we are cynical about truth. They start to deflate when we put faith back again in public reason. And if you look at the history, we have always prevailed. And it's not the checks and balances that we have, although the Senate has played very important roles and so have a lot of great leaders. But it's because the American people, in the end, always choose that demagogues are beneath them. And I honestly believe that that's the process that's happening right now, but these conversations have to be part of it. When the New York Times did a front page article on Monday analyzing every one of the 95,000 words that Trump had spoken in this campaign, showing that it was rife with division and deceit, that is important. The American people are smart. The Republican base is smart, and they can come to that decision on their own, but all Americans, all political leaders can help them make that decision. And I think that's where Trump, just like past demagogues, will ultimately fall.
Any other demagogues in this race?
You know, I had come pretty close to concluding that Ted Cruz was trying to be a demagogue. He was threatening rules of governance, you know, countermanding the entire U.S. Senate for his own agenda and shutting down the government.
I think the one place where he fails is that he doesn't trigger great waves of emotion.
I also think he has a difficulty coming across as a man of the common people, as an avatar for the masses. But he is trying very hard on both fronts.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Michael Signer is a political theorist and author based in Charlottesville, Virginia, where he's also a Democratic member of the city council.
You're not going to keep talking. We will go to break if you keep talking. We're going to ask you questions.
Go to break right now.
We'll be right back with more Morning Joe.
This was Monday, 5 days after the San Bernardino massacre, and just over 5 miles from the site of the crime. A cable news crew had found a familiar location for a stand-up.
Investigators say they don't know if anyone was involved. Investigators say they don't know if anyone else was involved in the planning of the attack, and at this point they see no evidence of any planning from outside the United States. In Redlands, California, Jonathan Hunt, Fox News. Right? Do you want me to do another one of this?
Behind him, the boarded-up condo apartment at 53 North Center Street, Redlands. It was already an iconic image because not only did the alleged killers live and conspire there, it had already been the scene of a historic moment in the annals of breaking and entering.
We have a bedroom here, and spread out appears to be credit cards and IDs. So here's California ID.
MSNBC's Kerry Sanders last Friday sifting through the banal detritus of evil.
I'm going to step away here. We have a California driver's license.
Moments earlier, dozens of journalists had stormed the premises, rifling frantically through the couple's belongings like bargain hunters at Lowman's. The unexpected real-time episode of the lives of the dead and infamous was so sudden, so unstoppable, and so unhinged that social media exploded in revulsion. Even CNN's Anderson Cooper expressed incredulity at what he was showing his own viewers.
Harry, it just seems, strikes me as bizarre what we're seeing.
It seemed like the apotheosis of what disgusts the majority of Americans who are disgusted with the media.
Vultures, jackals, and hyenas vie with each other, each taking its share where it can, using the tools at its disposal. Razor beaks, serrated teeth, or grinding jaws.
A bunch of slavering scavengers? Hold that thought. Meantime, where have we seen anything like this before? A door broken through, a breathtaking breach, an uncontrollable dark force.
Here's Johnny!
No, I mean a really dark force. Cynical, greedy, and shameless.
Now what, if anything, that vault contains, we don't know. This is an adventure you and I are going to be taking together.
Yeah, it had its echoes, but at least Geraldo never acted like Al Capone's vault mattered. Once again, last Friday on MSNBC.
Now, as I turn around here, I think I find something interesting. As we look at the floor here, this is a prayer rug. So this prayer rug here may have been, I'm not sure which way, but you would face it towards Mecca.
If Twitter blew up with rage, the neighbors of Syed Rizwan Farouk and Tashfeen Malik were somewhat more philosophical, or let's just say ambivalent.
Well, it was a media circus. There were so many newsmen here.
Glad, I guess, to see how the media was covering us and giving us a first view of what had happened there.
I think the way they were pushing each other was pretty repulsive. I mean, I don't mind the news reporting as long as they don't act like animals while they're doing it.
Linda Hamilton and her husband live directly across Center Street from the alleged shooter's condo. Last Friday, as the frenzy unfolded, they toggled between their window and the television. And as she viewed, Linda pondered the salient question.
I kept asking myself, so what is the media really responsible for reporting to the public? What does the public really need to know versus what is just pure sensationalism? It's a hard line to draw, but, you know, the facts rather than speculation would be one part of it.
Well, yes, that. But, of course, in her very question also lies the explanation. In the natural vacuum of authoritative information in the hours and days after a tragedy, whether a crime or a natural disaster, there is a lot of airtime to fill, and any new detail takes on disproportionate value, whereupon all rationality is displaced by what Alan Greenspan has called irrational exuberance and what is usually called mania. And if you can show a picture of it, well, Katie bar the door, MSNBC.
And it looks like somebody's nice birthday party there.
Let's not show the child, Kerry.
I'm sorry, Andrea. This is sort of unfolding live as we're doing it, so I'm not sure what the next picture is going to be until I pull them open.
There is news in its finished form, in print and broadcast. There is news in process, live press conferences, where the public gets to see the press at work and is sometimes appalled at the artlessness of it all. The sausage making, they call that, which is sometimes unappetizing, but usually yields at least a palatable product. Then there was Redlands, a nauseating grind of current events viscera that would never become a sausage. The process itself was the product, and it was disgusting. But as the old punchline goes, the portions are so big. The info looting at 53 North Center fed not only the bottomless cable news appetite for details, but also the viewers' unbounded curiosity. I asked a woman named Virginia Smith, who set up a prayer station outside the San Bernardino shooting site, about media consumption in what she called the fallen world.
Did you personally feel a little dirty at your desire to see
the belongings and the ephemera of the life of these killers?
Yes. I felt it was not going to be the best thing for me to be viewing, and it was not the best thing for me to be viewing.
So exactly what was this episode an apotheosis of? An overheated media marketplace, or merely nature in all its simplicity and brutality? Was scavenger really the right analogy? Patricia Johnson is a professor of microbiology at UCLA. I asked her if the press feeding greedily on the Redlands photo op is part of a larger ecosystem, one that ultimately feeds the primal appetites of the audience.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Of course they were. But that's what they do.
What do you do for a living? What's your specialty?
I do primarily biomedical and basic research in parasitology.
So would it be fair to say you know a parasite when you see one?
Yes.
So it's official. Parasites. Cable news, certainly. But also, us.
Coming up, the life and death of a crusading journalist.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When it emerged in the early 80s, AIDS was creeping selective death. On a December day 25 years ago, it entered the life of New York Times reporter Jeffrey Schmaltz. The disease set him on a new course, one that eventually changed the way the paper of record and many others around the country wrote about AIDS and gay life. Jeff Schmaltz was a prodigy at the Times. He dropped out of college to become a copy editor. Rising up the ladder, he was a deputy national editor by the time he was 37. He's the subject of a new hour-long documentary we link to at onthemedia.org. Our excerpted version begins with Sam Friedman, who'd just been hired at the Times when he met Jeff. Jeff became Sam's mentor and his friend.
From the time I was a teenager, my dream was to someday be a reporter on the New York Times. And on the day I started that job in 1981, I met my new boss. I was 26, and he was just 2 years older than me. He was a rigorous and inspiring editor who made me a better writer. And when my work met his lofty standards, he promoted it, sometimes getting me on the front page. There was another thing about Jeff. He was the first person in my life to tell me he was gay, confidently, unashamedly. But in the office, to his bosses, Jeff was tightly in the closet. Until this one day, just before Christmas in 1990, an unexpectedly quiet day on the national desk, Jeff was working editing copy.
Suddenly, I couldn't see the screen well, and I stood up. I thought, if I can just get some air, I'll be all right. I collapsed to the floor and went into a full-blown seizure, grand mal seizure, in the middle of the newsroom.
Jeff was soon diagnosed with AIDS, making him just one of nearly 8,000 people to be stricken by the incurable disease that year in New York City alone. Months later, Jeff was able to return to work, and when he did, he had a mission.
I feel an obligation to those with AIDS to write about it, and an obligation to the newspaper to write what just about no other reporter in America can cover in quite the same way. And I feel an obligation to myself. This is the place, reporting, where I'm at home. This is the place where I must come to terms with AIDS.
Soma Golden Bear was national editor of the Times then.
A lot of people were still closed off to AIDS. It's not in my life. Jeff took that in a poignant way. It wasn't just about one guy when you read it. It was everybody's brother, parent's kid, and I think that's been a huge part of what has transformed this country.
But newspaper articles don't last, especially articles that are now 25 years old. and I despaired that his work had been forgotten. My quest to bring it back to life led me here to a converted barn in upstate New York.
I was up here. Wow.
Jeff Schmaltz's sister Wendy lives in a small house a couple of hours north of New York City. She keeps Jeff's papers and notes in boxes, including cassette tapes of the dozens of interviews he did for his AIDS stories.
And I put in fresh
Each one has a label and a scribbled name.
Yeah, Magic Johnson.
Quentin.
Harold Brodkey, wow.
Wendy works today as a literary agent.
Barney Frank.
Like Jeff, her professional life led her a long way from where they both began, in a small Pennsylvania town.
We grew up in a suburb of Philadelphia called Willow Grove.
Their father was out of the picture, an alcoholic who died when Jeff was a teenager. Their mother worked as a manager at the local Sears.
It was hard in the early 60s to have two children and work full time, and I think she had to be very strict, and she always instilled in us a drive for perfection.
Jeff got into Columbia University with a special scholarship for fatherless boys. And since he'd worked on his high school newspaper, he applied for a copy boy's job on the New York Times. A copy boy's job in those days was to deliver stories from reporter to editor, from editor to printing press.
And he knew what he was carrying, and he knew what he was doing, and he knew what you were doing.
Alan Siegel was the news editor of the Times. He hired Jeff.
If an editor overlooked something, he'd tactfully bring the piece of paper back and say, "Didn't you mean to do something here?" And his suggestions were always on point.
For Jeff, the Times was a perfect fit. He dropped out of school at age 20 after being hired as a copy editor on the New York Times.
I don't know that I would want to be a newspaper man for anybody else. I'm a Times man.
He talked about that in a 1993 interview.
There's an anecdote, you know, some mayor of New York, I don't know if it was Jimmy Walker or whatever, and he asked if there were any reporters out there waiting to see him, and the aide said that there are four reporters and a gentleman from the Times.
Throughout the 70s and much of the 80s, as long as a gay reporter at the Times stayed secretive, the paper was willing to operate on a basis of don't ask, don't tell.
It was more a matter of omission rather than commission.
Rich Meislin, former editor and reporter at the New York Times.
Things that you didn't say, things that you didn't talk about, you know, the pronoun of who you saw last weekend, laughing at jokes where gay people were the butt of the joke. You'd laugh along because you had a cover to protect.
Even as gays and lesbians were struggling within the Times, reports began to emerge about a mysterious new illness striking gay men.
This is NBC Nightly News.
Scientists at the National Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta today released the results of a study which shows that the lifestyle of some male homosexuals has triggered an epidemic of a rare form of cancer.
The New York Times first reported on the disease in July 1981. It was a medical story under the headline, "Rare Cancer Seen in 41 Homosexuals." But the story was buried on page 20, just a single column stuck to the left of a big ad for holiday fireworks.
If it had been the Boy Scouts or PTA moms, it would have been on the front page.
Eric Marcus is a journalist and the author of Making Gay History. He was a network TV producer in the late 80s.
What I found when I worked in journalism during those years was a profession that was completely unprepared to cover gay people in general, let alone an epidemic.
When Eric worked at ABC's Good Morning America, he had to convince his colleagues to let him do a story about AIDS as part of a series on being single in America. But the show's film library only had a handful of stock images.
They showed gay men stripped to the waist, sweaty and gyrating in a disco, or they showed two guys holding hands, shot from behind, walking down Castro Street. But I wanted to show gay people beyond discos. And I got the Front Runners, which was an organization of gay runners here in New York, to allow me to come and shoot background footage. And they were thrilled because gay people were hungry for true portrayals in the media. We shot the footage, and the executive producer said no, that the only way that we could portray gay people in this segment was with footage of gay people at discos.
By 1983, more than 500 people in the United States had died from AIDS, and 1,000 others had been diagnosed. Jeff saw that the paper was missing a very big story. Mike Norman was a Metro reporter then, one of the strongest and straightest reporters on Jeff's desk. He was a former Marine who'd served in Vietnam and was now married and raising kids in the suburbs. Jeff convinced his boss, Peter Malonis, to assign Mike to do a big feature story on AIDS and gay life in the city.
And when Peter gave it to me, he said, just remember, we want you to write about gays as if you're writing about the daughters of the American Revolution. We don't want anything melodramatic, and above all, we don't want sex. I said, okay, I can do that. So I go walking out of Malonis's office, and I didn't get 10 or 12 feet before there's Schmaltz right in my face. And he says, you know I'm gay, don't you? I mean, I didn't know for sure, but I just said, of course, Jeffrey. He said, you're going to need help with this. And I remember two places that he took me to. They were nightclubs, and they were subterranean, both of them. And in one, you had to take off your shirt when you walked in the door. I said, okay, fine, I'll take off my shirt. So Jeff is not only talking to people he knew in these clubs, but he's also sort of half keeping an eye on me. And I got propositioned a bunch of times, you know. If it got to be too much, Jeff would always just kind of slip in and say, hi, I'm his editor. He's really got to work.
In 1990, Jeff was 37 years old and deputy national editor. And the newsroom had changed. There was an openness that came from a new executive editor, Max Frankel, and from the incoming publisher, Arthur Sulzberger Jr. Rich Meislin remembers.
Arthur was taking people out for lunch and asking them what it was like to be gay at the New York Times. And you, like, dropped your fork because the message it was sending was, I know and it's okay.
Gay and lesbian staffers started to test that new tolerance, even posting signs around the newsroom to gather a group for the annual Gay Pride March.
And the signs said, we're having a party, we'd love to invite you, but we don't know who you are.
The times had changed, but Jeff wasn't taking any chances. Maybe he could have come out if he'd been content to stay a regular reporter, but it was something else entirely to be an openly gay man on the masthead, and the masthead was where Jeff wanted to be. So he stayed in the closet to his bosses, at least until the December afternoon in late 1990, when he collapsed at his desk.
Doctors and medical technicians arriving, and I just remember this big fuss. And I remember kept telling people, I'm okay, I'm okay. And they kept saying, you're not okay.
Jeff's sister, Wendy, was at her office Christmas party.
When the phone rang, and it was someone at the Times who said that he had had a seizure in the newsroom and was rushed to St. Clair's Hospital. And Rich Meislin had gone with him.
It was horrible. Nobody understood why it was Jeff collapsed, including Jeff, although I suspect that he suspected.
I don't know, maybe an hour and a half later, Jeff comes out. I'm fine. Let's just go to Joe Allen's and have some dinner.
Jeff hadn't been tested for HIV before his collapse, but more seizures led to more tests. He went back to his doctor weeks later for the results.
He said, I must tell you that you officially have AIDS, and furthermore, your T-cell count is 2. Most normal people would have 1,000 T-cells. My life expectancy at that point was really a matter of weeks. And I remember getting in the cab, leaving my doctor. You know, we're talking about a 5-minute cab ride. And I thought, God, I hope I live just these 5 minutes. That was how much I thought I was going to die immediately.
He called me the day he got the diagnosis.
Jeff's sister, Wendy.
He was completely unsentimental and said, this is what I want for my funeral. This is what, don't tell mom because she shouldn't know yet. We have to figure out what we're going to do. Very businesslike. And again, over dinner, over martinis, it was just, it was like he was going away for vacation and I had to feed his fish. I mean, he was that matter of fact about it.
Jeff was equally matter of fact when he went to tell executive editor Max Frankel about his diagnosis.
I said, Max, I have the results of the tests, and it's very bad news. It's about as bad as it could be, actually. I have full-blown AIDS. And he looked stunned. And he said, does this surprise you? And I said, well, when you're a gay man, it's always in the back of your mind that you could have AIDS.
He left that day with every reassurance that if he were able to return, he'd still have a job at the paper. By that year, 1990, more than 60,000 people had already died of AIDS in the United States. For the next few months, Jeff was in and out of the hospital for pneumonia, for blood clots. He underwent brain surgery.
I think emotionally, I just collapsed. I just became so despondent. I just thought, this is it. I'll never recover from this.
But then, to everyone's astonishment, Jeff did recover. He went on AZT, the primary drug treatment at the time. He felt better, and he thought about taking whatever time he had left to travel. But then he realized,
it is not my way. And my way for 20 years has been the New York Times. The New York Times defines who I am in a lot of ways. And I wanted to work this out in the pages of the New York Times.
Even though the Times had become a much more tolerant place for its gay employees, the paper's coverage of the AIDS epidemic was widely criticized by gay activists. The group ACT UP even held a protest march outside the publisher's apartment. In their eyes, by not giving more prominent attention to the disease, the Times was contributing to the death of thousands of people.
In retrospect, I feel terrible that I wasn't more open and that I didn't say, wait a minute, this is outrageous. We're missing this epidemic. And I didn't. I was afraid. I was a coward, really. And one of the things that happened when I got AIDS was that I made the decision that I was not going to be timid about either having AIDS or being gay, and that I was going to speak out, and that I was going to use my position to help both those causes.
It was unheard of for a reporter at the Times to deliberately abandon his or her objectivity, especially on a topic where you had such a personal stake. But when he went back to work, Jeff wrote a series of profiles of people suffering from AIDS. All of them, like him, were still working in spite of the disease. A San Francisco AIDS doctor, a gay Bill Clinton campaign staffer, a mother infected by a blood transfusion, and Mary Fisher, a Republican insider, tapped to speak at the 1992 Republican convention.
I mean, I really confronted her and said, you know, how can you speak at this Republican convention when these Republicans have done nothing for AIDS? Enter now Mary Fisher, very rich, very Republican, and very much infected with the virus that causes AIDS. With her shoulder-length blonde hair styled just so, Ms. Fisher is right out of Republican central casting. The Muffy Buffy Jody look writ expensive. And why not? Her Republican credentials are impeccable.
You know, I didn't like that description of me, but other than that, I thought that the article was really right on, and I thought he was very honest.
Ms. Fisher, who so far has not had any AIDS-related illnesses, is caught between the worlds of Republican politics and AIDS activism, both of them at times uneasy about her.
He soon came to realize they had a lot in common with Mary Fisher. They both had to stop during the interview to take their doses of AZT, and they'd both chosen to be very public about their illness.
A few minutes later, at the door, she rushed up. "I want a big hug," she said. With that, she threw open her arms, squeezing tight, and whispered, "Stay well."
Jeff wrote about those small moments of connection. And when he did, he showed readers the experience of living with AIDS in precise and indelible ways. His fierce specificity was paradoxically the thing that made his article so broadly relevant, so universal.
The mission, on the one hand, is to just in general show the public that even an editor at the New York Times can get AIDS, that people in general with AIDS are not the scum of the earth. And also, I want people with AIDS to see me. I want them to hear the message that you're not dead immediately because you have AIDS. You're not dead till you're dead.
Coming up, Schmaltz transforms the public perception of gay men and women and the disease that was killing them.
This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We pick up the story of Jeff Schmaltz during the 1992 presidential race, when Schmaltz scored an interview with then-Governor Bill Clinton. Schmaltz asked him why he thought gay issues had emerged in the campaign. Clinton replied that AIDS had a lot to do with it. Sam Friedman.
Jeff's interview with Bill Clinton became part of a larger story about the emergence of a gay and lesbian constituency in American politics. It was like the entire community starting to come out of the closet.
Today's New York Times features an in-depth interview with Magic Johnson, but there is more to that story. The man who wrote it, Assistant National Editor Jeffrey Schmaltz, has AIDS.
Jeff went on the Charlie Rose Show to talk about his profile of basketball star Magic Johnson. Johnson was HIV positive, and he'd been forced to retire from the NBA. Other players said they felt it was too dangerous to play with him on the court.
Take us there to the time you two were talking.
He asked me a lot about myself, and then it got a little wrenching when we started sort of pressing back and forth, as happens in these AIDS.
What's wrenching?
Well, I asked him, had he not betrayed people with AIDS by pulling out of the league? And I think he was very stricken by that question coming from me. I don't think it would have been the same if it had come from you.
Right.
But then he came back with a very thoughtful answer, and he started talking on and on about his life and how he was really two people. He was Magic and he was Irvin, and how AIDS or HIV had changed his life. And
so that there was no more Magic.
Jeff's life was going through its own transformation. He was in a steady relationship, his first since college, and with a man he'd met at an AIDS support group. He bought an apartment near Lincoln Center, moving out of the place he'd occupied since college. Even his writing had changed. It became looser, more conversational, less Timesian. Old friends like columnist and novelist Anna Quinlan noticed something bigger going on.
It wasn't that Jeff's style changed. It was that Jeff's character changed. He was incredibly skilled, but he could be really arrogant and judgmental. When I first met him, there was a sense that he was judging you harshly because you'd messed up, because he was more capable than you were, which was almost always true, but is not attractive. And I hate to say it because the trope of the person and noble humanized by terrible illness is such a cliche, but in his case, it was completely true.
I mean, he whistled. You'd always know he's coming around the corner because you heard the sound of his whistle.
Adam Moss is now the editor of New York Magazine. Back then, he sat next to Jeff at the Times.
He was one of the happier-seeming people. I didn't know the old Jeff. I didn't know the button-down Jeff. I just knew this new Jeff who felt, I think, so relieved not to be carrying secrets, not to be having to perform the function of a Times man.
Jeff's articles in the Times began to gather growing attention. The New Yorker and New York Magazine ran features on him. ABC News profiled him. The star photographer Annie Leibovitz did a spread of Jeff at work for Vanity Fair. Then, in late 1992, Jeff tackled his most personal story yet, his own. When he did, the words poured out of him.
I took it over to Joe Lelyveld, who's the managing editor, and I said, I've written this piece. He came over a little while later and said, we'll print it. And that was it, and we put it in the newspaper.
That piece was titled A Reporter's Testimony, Covering AIDS and Living It. Jeff wrote about waking up with nightmares, where he was in a coffin. He wrote about his mother's death after she learned he had AIDS. He wrote about his sense of being completely alone.
I make sure everyone with AIDS whom I interview knows that I have it too. To be sure that is an interview ploy. I'm hoping the camaraderie will open them up. But there is more to it than that. I want them to take a good look at me, to see that someone with full-blown AIDS can carry on for a while. Much of the time it works. Their faces light up. There is hope. But sometimes it fails, and I am the one changed by our chat, overcome by guilt that I have lived these 2 years, when so many of my friends and hospital roommates and people I've interviewed have died. At times I think my fellow AIDS sufferers are laughing at me, looking up from their beds with eyes that say, you'll be here soon enough.
After the piece ran, Jeff got hundreds of letters from readers. They covered the whole range of attitudes at the time about gay men and about AIDS.
Some of them were incredibly nasty. I think all you bastards with AIDS ought to just die. You ought to be in a home, the least expensive ones possible, until you die, pretty much what one of them said recently. Most of the letters are favorable and very moving. You know, a wonderful letter from a woman in Florida, my son died of AIDS, whose name was also Jeffrey, and she detailed his agonizing death. She was running it to me, like so many of them write, to use me really as the sounding board for just venting all of their own emotions and their own horrors with this disease. And then she ended the letter by saying, consider this letter a mother's hug. And I cried, really, when I read that letter. I carry it around with me and read it from time to time.
In February of 1993, he addressed students at a private school in Manhattan.
Do you ever feel cheated?
When you think that you're going to die, as I did, and then you rebound and you live, and not only live but thrive, you don't feel cheated, you feel blessed. I stand before you as someone who was given time, a year now, that I never thought I would have, and time that I've been able to put to really good use. I'm proud of that.
Jeff made sure the students knew there was no escape from the reality of his situation.
It's like knowing that you're going to be killed by a speeding car, but you don't know what moment, you don't know what day. It could happen this afternoon, it could happen 2 years from now. And so you always live with this sense of, my God, this car is running to me. When is it going to hit me?
By now, Jeff knows that no last-minute miracle will save him. Worse still, he senses that national interest in AIDS is waning.
We were talking, and he uttered the phrase, whatever happened to AIDS? And I said to him, that's a magazine article.
Adam Moss was then the editor of the New York Times Magazine. He encouraged Jeff to write a major article about the state of AIDS.
The thesis of the story is very simple. A lot of the political wars had been won. It was no longer a function of getting funding for AIDS. AIDS had come up against a wall, and that wall was the wall of science. Is that with all of the money and with all of the sort of changed policies, they were still stuck at this moment when they could not solve the disease.
The heart of the piece is Jeff's despair that the suffering of AIDS victims is still being pushed to the margins.
I usually say that my epitaph is not a phrase, but the body of my work. But actually, there is, in fact, a phrase that I once shouted at my funeral and written on the memorial cards, a phrase that captures the mix of cynicism and despair that I feel right now and that I will almost certainly take to my grave. Whatever happened to AIDS?
The piece alternates between Jeff's personal experiences living with AIDS, taking his boyfriend to the emergency room on a Sunday morning, and his interviews with key AIDS doctors, activists, and public health officials. He fleshed out the first-person sections early on, but by late summer, Jeff was getting sicker and weaker.
One was torn as his editor and his friend between wanting to push him, yet not to push him because there were clearly more important things happening to him, which is that he was sort of grappling with his end.
Jeff's brain infection returned. He went to lunch one day with a longtime friend and colleague on the Times, David Dunlap.
And as we walked back toward the Times headquarters, Jeff had his arm through mine, partly out of fondness, perhaps out of just physical support to help keep him steady. And it was clear that he wanted to stay arms locked until we had to negotiate the revolving door. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I'm walking arm in arm with another man toward the New York Times building and having that old fear, like, what if they see me? Who is they?
By the fall, Jeff was at home. He could no longer speak, but the urge to write never left him. Jeff's brother-in-law, Michael Wilde, recalls one particular day when Jeff gestured that he wanted a pen and paper.
And, you know, I remember the nurse saying, don't even bother with that. And I remember Wendy saying, he's a writer. He needs to have this. It would take him a long time, but he would write stuff out. And one of the last things he wrote out was, this is odious, dying is monstrous.
David Dunlap lived a few blocks away. Early one morning, he got a call. Come quick.
There was a nurse there, and Wendy was there. We're in the bedroom. We gather around Jeff. I recall having my left arm under Jeff's shoulder and head so that he was cradled in the crook of my left elbow. And basically, it was a matter, as you do with the dying, of saying, as we did, it's all right. You've done your job. You've got love is everywhere around you. And that was the end. I mean, then all of the things began to kick in that you do, the calls and the coroner and the removal of the body and all of that.
Jeff Schmaltz died on November 6, 1993. He was 39. Jeff's obituary ran in the New York Times and other major newspapers around the country. But even in death, he had his critics. U.S. News and World Report published a column deriding Jeff's first-person journalism. Jeff's sister, Wendy.
In Jeff's will, it says, "Under no circumstances am I to be buried in the family plot in Willow Grove, Pennsylvania." He didn't want to go home again.
Jeff's friends and family gathered early one morning a week later on one of the piers along the Hudson River, a place that had famously been a gay cruising spot. Jeff's brother-in-law, Michael Wilde, reading from his diary.
"Scattering the ashes, 6:30 a.m. at the Christopher Street Pier on West Street, what Jeff jokingly referred to as the scene of the crime. The somber moment approaches, the tin is opened, and we discover the remains of Jeff in a plastic bag. Ben opens this with a Swiss Army knife, and Rich peers into the can and describes the contents as gravelly. A sober silence is observed, and Jeff is scattered to the wind. This wasn't Jeff the hero, it was just Jeff, and we were his family."
2 weeks later, the Times ran Jeff's final story with the title, "Whatever Happened to AIDS?"
On Sunday, the cover story in the New York Times Sunday magazine was written by a journalist named Jeffrey Schmaltz, who lived and just a couple of weeks ago died with AIDS.
President Clinton gave his World AIDS Day address a few days later on December 1st.
He was a remarkable man who interviewed me in a very piercing way last year when I was running for president. He challenged us all with these words in the article, "I am dying. Why doesn't someone help us?" I have to say to you that I think that is a good question and a good challenge.
A week later, a public memorial took place at the Dalton School in Manhattan.
"Good evening. Thank you for joining us here tonight."
The high school auditorium was packed with mourners, and David Dunlap gave one of the final tributes. He said the way Jeff described gay life jumped out at the reader from the long gray columns of the Times.
"Jeff's choice of words let readers know the writer knew his subject, that he moved with familiarity through the territory he was describing, that he recognized its pace and its quirks. No question about it, Jeff was pushing hard, very hard, and not everyone was pleased, but something important began to happen. Straight readers were making our acquaintance more intimately than ever before, and gay readers who had known only an anguished loyalty to an ignorant and indifferent Times began to feel as if their stories might finally find a hope in our pages. Something else happened. Those of us at the Times who saw ourselves in the vanguard during the 1980s learned quickly, thanks to Jeff, what it meant to come all the way out of the closet, to make demands and take risks."
Today, there are gay TV stars, gay athletes, gay politicians, and marriage equality is the law of the land. Hardly anyone seems to realize how big a part Jeff's AIDS coverage and his role as the out gay star of the New York Times played in all this positive social change. Eric Marcus, the author of Making Gay History.
So much has changed in the last 20 years, 25 years, that it makes it hard to understand why he mattered and why he made such a difference. Today, I don't have to follow the gay press to understand where we are in the gay rights movement. I read the New York Times.
Jeff wrote about 36 stories on AIDS in the year and a half before he died. Nearly all of the people he profiled with AIDS died not long after he did. And they were just some of the more than 600,000 people who've died in the United States since the epidemic began. AIDS caused Jeff Schmaltz to collapse on that December afternoon 25 years ago. And facing death, Jeff asked himself some hard questions.
Here's your life. This is it. If you died tomorrow, would you be happy? Would you feel you had achieved what you wanted to achieve? Is this how you want to go out of this world, the way you are right now? And the answer came back, no, it isn't how I want to go out. Okay, let's change it, and let's change it now. We don't have a lot of time here. And I did. I just changed it really very quickly. I've constructed this life that I have right now. I'm extremely happy in a certain way. I know that sounds ridiculous. Here I am dying. Yet my life, in a lot of ways, has never been happier, has never been more directed. I mean, I feel more content. I feel that this is where I should have been all along, and I'm sorry that it took a fatal disease to do it, but better late than never.
This was a shorter version of Dying Words, the AIDS reporting of Jeffrey Schmaltz, a documentary produced by Kerry Donahue and Sam Friedman and edited and mixed by Ben Shapiro. To hear the full version and check out the companion book, go to dyingwordsproject.com.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Alex Friedland and Dasha Litsitsina. Thanks to WNYC's archivist Andy Lancet. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Means.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.